Everybody, welcome, welcome. You've joined us in Paradigm Shifters, and we're meeting tonight somebody who's been gracing us before. We talked to you in November, Bruce. We're meeting with Bruce Lipton again, talking about the spontaneous evolution of our time. Now, Bruce is calling us from the future, right?
Absolutely. It's tomorrow already, and I can tell you from this far, it's a beautiful tomorrow going to happen.
What on earth are you doing in New Zealand?
Well, I have the fortunate pleasure of teaching at the New Zealand College of Chiropractic, which is an exciting opportunity to be in New Zealand, which right away it's like, great lessons that we all need to learn about living in community can be experienced down here. So I get a double hit of being able to teach and also to live in a wonderful environment.
Wow. Well, I'm originally from B.C., and I hear British Columbia, and I hear that New Zealand's a lot like British Columbia, is it?
It's funny. I live in Santa Cruz, and the geographical location where I live in Santa Cruz, to the hour, minute, and second, is where I live down here in Auckland on the southern side. So it's real interesting because it has the exact same feeling to it as Northern California up to Vancouver. It's a beautiful, beautiful environment.
Oh, well, that's great. It's a little bit more rural feeling, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the size of California with about 4 million people, and 3 million of them live in the cities, meaning the entire rest of the area is covered by 1 million people, which means in that area, hardly see anybody down there. It's just beautiful. It's Middle Earth. It's just what they did in Lord of the Rings. It's not a movie set. It's actually the country.
Wow. So you really have shifted dimensions on us, huh?
Absolutely, but it's great because it says we have great options in front of us, and I'm really looking forward to them because it's a time of crisis, as you know, that's what we're here and talking about. And yet, what's really interesting about crisis is that it also is opportunity. So,
yeah,
I see it from that side a bit.
Oh, good. And you're not there permanently, are you?
No, I'm here just about 4 months of the year, and then come back and then work from the States.
Wow, I'm really glad we get to talk to you in such a different environment. So how do they feel down in New Zealand about a lot of the work that you're talking about biology of belief and about the up-and-coming spontaneous evolution, or do you talk about that down there?
Well, I do talk about it, and I've had a lot of audiences, a lot of email from people here, and I've been on the radio a few times, and they're very open to new ideas and new thinking, and they're very much in the same kind of direction that I talk about how to deal with the environment and how to keep harmony and preserve nature. And it's very important for them. That's a built-in national credo into their behavior and psyche, is to take care of the environment, because they've always known they've had one of the most unusual, geobiological environments on the planet, with all the strange animals and things that come from here. And so they keep it, they see this as preserving a piece of this very unique geography on the planet. So built into the population is really an intention of living in harmony with the environment and maintaining it. And so it's great to, you know, be around an environment that's fully encouraging of that behavior.
Wow, that's exciting, because when I was listening to, I listened to our last interview, which I loved, and it was in early November, and when we came to the end, you were saying, and there's so, you know, we were saying, oh my gosh, we have to cut it short before all of the wisdom has come out. And what we were talking about is all the consciousness and all the things we can do to make things different and to meet the spontaneous evolution. And it sounds like you're kind of basking in it in a way. I mean, living in a kind of environment.
It's kind of fun because you can really, it can be real and you can experience this way, and you, and it's very interesting to live in a country that is not connected with war in any way and doesn't make any profit from war in any way. So it's real interesting to be in a place where war is not part of a dialogue or a public, you know, that's not on the public mind. And when you leave the United States and then come here and feel like, oh, kind of peaceful all of a sudden, we realize how much we are creating our own stresses in this regard, because here's a country that is doing quite well without those very same stresses.
And so what about technology? Is it really big into technology?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is where they see their future, because it's not a massive rich, you know, with minerals and things like that, where they're going to collect stuff from the earth. So they do otherwise, and it's real interesting because the movie industry is really booming down here, and they're very avant-garde and very leading edge. In fact, James Cameron's much of Avatar was actually produced and created down here in New Zealand at Weta Laboratories down in Wellington. And so they
were
primarily responsible for most of the animation that was in that in that system. So yeah, they're very creative.
Did you see the floating mountains down there?
What? Excuse me?
Have you seen the floating mountains down there?
I've seen lots of mountains. I don't know many of them floating, but maybe that's just the cloud line.
That's just an Avatar. It's probably an animation in itself.
So, I understand that you just recently seen Avatar.
Yesterday, yes.
Mind blowing.
Did you like it?
I was just taken by every aspect, from the technical part, the 3D, and the just the amazing animation stuff. But then I was also more deeply moved by the myth, the story, the tale that it has to tell us of how important it is for us to start to recognize that we are this environment. The environment, even though religion and science have essentially told us we've been separate from the environment. I mean, religion talks about, okay, creationism, that the environment was created and then we were added like an option at the very end, so we were like an add-on. Science really detaches us, but in a different sense, because science says, if we understand the conventional Darwinian point of view, that we got here by accidents of genetic mutation. So then if you said, well, then tell me about what purpose might we have, and you start with the premise that it was an accident, then you're only left with the conclusion, well, we have no purpose here. We just got here by accident. And in that case, that detaches us from our deep connection with the environment, because in biological reality, we are made as a complement to the environment. We evolved in an environment. We adapted to an environment. And what science has been trying to get us to understand, and it's very hard for a lot of people to get, but it's a very simple fact, is we and the environment are one and the same. That when we alter the environment, we alter the identity that humans have with that environment. So as we get further out and destroy the environment, we're less capable of surviving. And so basically, science has fully recognized that we are deep into the sixth mass extinction of life, five previous ones attributed to things like comets or asteroids destroying the environment and causing an upheaval and generally wiping out life to just little bits that start over again. Science now recognizes that we're deep into the sixth mass extinction. And the significance about that is science has recognized that the cause of this is a lot closer to home than comets and asteroids, that the cause is actually human behavior, that the way we treat each other and then the way we use that kind of behavior to treat the planet has disturbed the environment to such an extent that it's not really supporting us as much. And we become threatened by it, and the species losses are going at such rates that science, at least in their history, have never recorded anything like this. So they're attributing the loss to the beginning of this mass extinction. So, well, it's the beginning of the extinction. And we then know that we, as a human civilization, have been instrumental in precipitating this. So we're at a juncture in our evolution, because if we continue doing just what we're doing, science already told us where we're going. We are going extinct, no question. Mm-hmm. So it leaves us with a choice. You can just keep doing what we're doing, or we radically undergo a metamorphosis, a transformation, and live differently on this planet. And what's so exciting
about it. And that's an option that we make? We make that option?
That's the exciting part about this evolution. It's like the previous evolution was our physical expression, our being here in a physical body. That was an evolution process. But the evolution that we're going to or engaged in at this very moment is not an evolution of the body, but it's an evolution of the consciousness of that body. So that what we're beginning to understand is that we are more than what we thought we were. We have great limitations on our belief and our connectivity to this planet, and that we are also really beginning to own a scientific fact that was demonstrated when quantum mechanics appeared on the planet. Quantum mechanics revealed, very simply, that the observer is involved with creating the results of an experiment. That when you do an experiment, you as an observer are not just like looking through a glass window and the experiment's going on the other side. As an observer, your consciousness is involved. So quantum physics in 1925 said very clearly that the universe that we live in is more of a conscious creation than a physical reality, that human consciousness is involved with shaping the world that we live in. And the relevance about that is we are now going through a process of evolving our consciousness. And it's interesting because we're being put into a crisis, and crisis is an opportunity. It says, oh, well, you're in a crisis and you can see where you're going. And if you don't do anything, then you already know what it's all about. But the opportunity is if you do something, you can avert this whole crisis. And what's happening, and people are unconsciously doing it without, it's not a big movement led by a lot of leaders in one sense, although there are some, but there's a movement of people starting to recognize there's more to the world than what we've been led to believe. That there is an influence of the way we think and the way we behave on the way the world manifests itself. That if we change our attitudes and change our beliefs and change our just the way we see the world, we change the world. And it's interesting because we are in a complete scientific change of beliefs that is facilitating a civilization's change in beliefs because, simply, civilization is building itself on the beliefs of science. That's why we say, oh, that's scientific, because then it means, oh, that's a truth that we must follow. And then we say, well, that's unscientific, and then that means, oh, that's basically maybe not true. And so the point is the science that we have been living on since Charles Darwin's time has created the belief system that we operate by on a day-by-day basis. And the reality is, it's our behavior that is causing our extinction. And I love Albert Einstein, just great. I mean, but this quote is very particularly relevant. Einstein said, you cannot solve the problems with the same thinking that created them. And why is that relevant? The answer is, well, the world, the way we are living and the behaviors we are expressing are creating the problems. And then we look, but the institutions that we have, the institutions are promoting the behaviors that we have. So the way we behave to each other, the way we behave to the planet, are parts of our belief system designed by our science and our social connections and all this other stuff. But the science really was the one that gave us the shape because science gave us the fundamental truths that we live by, and that's the truth of Darwinian theory. And Darwinian theory says we got here by accidents of mutation. Darwinian theory says that to survive and evolve, then you're continuously engaged in a struggle for survival. And that the winners of the struggle are those that we call the fittest in the competition for life. So we've been living by that, in that our institutions are always based on a competition win-lose scenario, that we're basing it on the reality that we're in this competition and that if you can get more than the other person, then you're more fit than the other person. So there's this competitive edge for us to actually pillage the planet, to acquire.
It's a kind of voracious thing. It's voracious.
Exactly. It's what Avatar was talking about. It's like push it to the end. There is this Garden of Eden, and then humans need this stuff, which I love was called unobtainium. And basically, what were they going to do? They were going to, you know, bulldoze that thing and make a parking lot out of that beautiful garden. And the reality is, well, this is what we're doing. That's what the story, well, it's a story in one sense. It's really an overview, a global myth of what are we doing? We had a garden and to get these things that we thought were necessary, we've undermined the entire garden to the extent that we threaten ourselves.
I love at the beginning when she teaches him that everything has to work together. You know, when she's teaching him how the energy
yes.
of one thing and another, everything is in. I went, this is such a widely seen movie, this is a brilliant teaching tool, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's fun because I teach a lot, and one of the things that I just love about teaching today compared to the old days, which was more like the stern taskmaster up in the front with a yardstick ready to hit somebody on the head with it, teaching today is much more fun when we use something, a mode called edutainment. Edutainment means that I can use education in a form that is entertaining, and that keeps people there and entranced. And James Cameron's Avatar is exquisite edutainment because people are riveted and then all of a sudden feel like, oh my God, yes, it's aligning with this beautiful thing called nature and harmonizing with it is where the beauty and joy of the world comes from. So, it really, in the subconscious minds of everyone that sees it, is getting that visual image of, you know, if we took care of this place, it could be that. And that's what I love about the message, and because it's widely spread, it's not preachy, it's just a story, but that story touches our deepest essence of humanity. And that humanity essence is the nature of a Gaia, which means the earth is one giant living system. And everything on this earth is part of that system. There's no way you could be on this planet and not part of Gaia. And what, unfortunately, as I said, our perceptual background has always been that we got here separate from Gaia. And as a result, we're just like visitors, you know, accidental tourists that ended up here. And we're not very, very polite because, we've soiled the place. and this is the wake-up call. And it's coming from many different directions. And the most important direction it's coming from is from the listeners that we have with us today. Veronica, these listeners are what I would call cultural creatives. Cultural
right.
creatives. These people are looking and saying there are other ways, there are alternative answers and solutions than the situation that we're in. And I go back to that Einstein quote, and he said, you can't change, you can't solve the problems with the same thinking that created. And then I go back and say, yeah, the institutions that we have bought us, this is the way life is, academics, healthcare, government, economy, they all seem to be crashing. And it's like, I'm sitting over here like the one of the few people in the whole world jumping up and down, clapping, going, yay, it's coming down.
Well, hey, Bruce, let me ask you something. You know, you were, you excited us all with biology of belief. And then you mentioned something about the movie Avatar going, how much, like, for example, we're watching a movie like Avatar. How much impact does that actually have on our subconscious to actually change those more primitive drives, defensive, competitive drives, we thought. Movies can do a lot, can they not? Or do you know anything about that?
Yeah, absolutely, because they resonate with something that is the core of all of us. There's something, it's very interesting, all of us look different, essentially, and we all have these different behaviors, and we can try to average and say, you know, what is a human behavior and all that, and then I would step back in and I would say, there's an interesting issue where it comes up with Down's children, Down syndrome. And what's interesting about them is that, first of all, they all have very similar faces. They're like a basic clone of a human being, okay? And it's very interesting because before they have their separate identities and before they become distinguishable as other people, they tend to, as a group, to look very similar and behave very similarly. So it says, underneath our personal identity somewhere, there's the equivalent of this Down's child. And I said, well, what does that mean? Well, it means this. An individual who lives in wonder, an individual who lives in a childhood joy, that's where they live. And until we mess with it, that's their lives. They're like, always like, just like children that wake up every day and look at the beauty and the joy and they just have this great heart. And it's interesting because this is actually, I believe, at the very core of every human is that core, and then we dress ourselves with our personal identity. Well, the relevance about the underlying core of the human is that if you can resonate with that core, it can cause that inner person's core to resonate and respond. And that's why I really believe when you see something like Avatar, and you walk out of the theater, you yourself have been affected. You physiologically are affected by the movie. And then you realize, but so is everyone else. And there's a commonality to that effectiveness, a wonder, an excitement. And what it really is, I think, is it's appealing to and resonating with a core value of what humans evolved from. And that is that we came into this place with a garden that was beautiful. And it was really an opportunity for us to become aware of how to live in this garden most effectively. That was our evolution as civilization. But on that path, every time we made an advance, it was also we brought some stuff along that wasn't that good, or created some new things in our beliefs that weren't that good. And so at the very core, although we have that old purity of being what do you call a human? And a human, you say, well, what's a human? And I say, well, define humane. Humane is the character from which human comes from. Humane is a compassionate, a loving, that kind of energy. We talk more about dolphins are more humane, I think, than humans are at this point. But if we can catch that core, then the more people that start to resonate with that, the larger the population that resonates with that, it returns back to the environment. And there's a critical mass that can occur, which will then like ring the bell. It sets off the threshold that we all of a sudden start to move. And we are moving that way. I see it very much. I mean, I can look at my own personal experiences. I remember talking, my first public talks about the biology of belief were in 1985. In 1985, if I get two or three people to sit long enough and listen to it, I thought that was great, you know. And then over the years, more and more people started to come up, and more people. And then around 2000, it was really exciting for me because after 15 years of presenting this, around 2000 doctors started to come to my lecture, which is really important because it's really talking about how mind and health are involved, and they never came up to then. And then more and more, and every day and every year since then has been more, and there are more and more people that are interested and more readers. And what does it mean? More people are seeking another way of life right now. Rather than giving up and saying, oh, that's it, that's the end, this is the way it is, which would be unfortunate, there are people out there in the audience right now, they're saying, I'm really looking for a better way because I know what's out there, but my inner core, my inner humane humanity knows that there's a better way of life. And what's interesting about it, well, our physical evolution as a human body really didn't have us as a participant as much as a recipient of the evolution. The current evolution that we're involved in, we have to be active participants because it's an evolution of consciousness, an understanding of who we really are. I could simplify it, but it still has to be felt and experienced. But the simplification is very much this. I talk about in biology of belief that you look at a human body and in a mirror it looks like a single entity looking back at you. And then I say, but if you really had microscopic eyes where you could focus up really closely, you would see you're not a single body. You are actually a thriving community of 50 trillion cells. The cells are the living entity. Me, when I say me, Bruce, that's a collective word of a community. I speak Bruce, but I'm 50 trillion cells that are making this voice and all this. So why that becomes important is like, we understand that we are a social community of cells. And why that becomes relevant is then the next level of evolution is when the human individual, each listener, me, you, Veronica, each one of us, recognizes that we are individual cells in something larger. It's a superorganism, and that superorganism is called humanity. And if you look at that and understand that's what the evolution is, that we're all going into a oneness of being in the same one organism, and we stop fighting each other, which is very interesting because one of the biggest illnesses in human biology today is called autoimmune disease, which is a disease in which your own cells attack yourself. It's interesting because as humanity on the outside is expressing that, we are mirroring that exact same thing inside the bodies of each human, not each human, but the humans affected. And so really basically what it says is, what would happen if all of us recognized we were all cells in one big giant human organism? And then I would say, well, you know what would happen? It would be, imagine if you could be right now just one of your cells in your human body and recognize when you are in a full state of happiness and health, which is something I call the honeymoon experience, when you're feeling that overjoyed love that floods through you, realize that if you're feeling that, 50 trillion citizens inside under your skin are experiencing that at the same time. And what I would like to suggest is, when we recognize the nature of our oneness, our unity, that we're all here to help each other. I mean, the stomach doesn't invade the pancreas and try to capture the Isles of Langerhans. You know, it's like every organ system is like a nation that lives in harmony and works with every other organ system. And the harmony that comes from that brings this human body to this exquisite state. And what's available for humanity and what we're getting into is recognizing that, yeah, we're all cells in the same body. And if we understand that, then when we all cooperate, then we get that kind of experience where 50 trillion cells could be blissed out at the same time. Hey, a few billion people can be blissed out. If you get 50 trillion to be blissed out, a few billion can easily be blissed out. And that's our future. That's out there if we do something. And if we don't, hey, we know where it's going right now.
Well, you know, when you're talking in spontaneous evolution about doing something, you referred to how the subconscious has a huge amount of drive in each of us, and that we should be working, and your recommendation at one section was to be doing our repeated statements, talking to ourselves in a positive way and so on. So, for example, if we're going to dump competition as a basic underlying thing, we would want to approach it consciously, keep driving into the subconscious that there's no competition, there's no need for it, and so on. Is that right still, A and B? Will a movie be able to impact me that much that I don't have to write so many letters and lines to myself?
That's a long question. I would love to have a movie. I would love to have a movie reveal what's really going on. And it's an interesting thing because it's at the very root of how come for thousands of years there have been very influential people that have repeated the same thing over and over again, and even more so today. And that's the nature of what they're saying. You know, as a person thinketh, that is what they become, or some kind of, you know, variation on a thing where your thoughts create your life. People have been telling this all the time. And people say, well, that's really neat. So you mean if I do some positive thinking, I'm going to have a positive life? And so skeptically, of course, we try a lot of positive thinking. It doesn't really work for a lot of people, and in fact, so much so that there's this disconnect that says, well, hey, if it was just positive thinking, we all could have been there by now, because we all tried it here and there, and it never really worked. And so the idea is that we have given up on what is absolutely the truth. It is our thought that creates the world around us, and that, in fact, positive thinking does create health and harmony and the beauty of life, and that we are actually creating this world with the way we behave. And then you say, well, how come it doesn't work? And I say, because there's been a piece left out of the puzzle that would make sense out of it, and if you don't understand this piece, then there's a complete disconnect from them. There's no meaning to what I just said. Positive thinking means nothing to most people. And that's because we left out the piece. And here's the piece, if I can try and summarize it quickly. It's the mind is what's controlling our reality. That's where our consciousness lies. But we have two minds. We have a conscious mind and a subconscious mind. The conscious mind is the one connected to your personal identity, your spiritual source, you as the individual. That's the conscious mind. The subconscious mind is actually almost a depersonalized machine. The subconscious mind is a device that learns pattern, and then at the push of a button can replay the pattern. The subconscious mind is essentially habits. When you learn how to do something, you don't have to relearn it each time. And when you need to do it, you push the button, and then it happens without you even thinking about it. So the subconscious mind downloads experiences, saves them as habits, and plays them as tapes that you push the tape and it plays. And the conscious mind, totally different. The conscious mind, the one that's connected with the personal identity spirit, is creative. That's the one that comes up with the ideas. That's the one that thinks about things and has desires. It has wishes. It has aspirations of what it wants. I say, Veronica, tell me what you want from your life. Whatever answer you give me, I would most likely guess that answer came from your conscious mind, because that's what the conscious mind does. It says, what would you like? It creates. So I say, yeah, that's the mind that has positive thinking, because that's the one that says, yeah, let's create this positive thing. And so positive thinking. So I say, okay, so we have the two minds. One plays tapes. One is creative. Okay, now here comes the problem in a nutshell. And the problem is this. We believe in our minds that we're running our life with our wishes and our desires and our aspirations. We wake up every day with, yeah, I have an intent. I'm going to be successful. I'm going to find the right relationship. I'm going to get the best job. And these are great intentions. And we wake up and then we go through life. And then we find at the end of the day, as we come home licking our wounds, going, wow, that didn't work that good today, but maybe tomorrow we'll go out and do it again. And what do we learn from that during the day? It's like, well, obviously, I'm not creating my life, because I went out in the morning with this great list of wishes and came home with really nothing, and therefore, I'm not creating my life. That there are forces outside of me that are preventing me from getting to where I want to go. And as soon as you say that, then you said, I'm a victim. I'm a victim because it's the forces that controlled me, and I didn't have anything to do with it, so I must live with the fate of these forces, whatever they are. So we become more irresponsible along the way, because it says, well, why should I try? You know, I tried all those years. It never worked, so why should I care anymore anyway? And then we become more irresponsible, and it all falls apart. Now, here's what the point is. We were creating all day long. But what happens is this. Neuroscience has revealed that only about 5% of our cognitive creative activity or consciousness is actually coming from the conscious mind. That 95% of our behavior is driven by the habits or tapes or experiences that are logged into the subconscious mind. Well, the two important points about that. Well, first, 95% of your life is coming from the programs, okay? And number two, it's called subconscious for a reason. Sub, below, conscious. Meaning, when these operations, these tapes, these programs are playing, they're playing below consciousness. You don't see them. So it's funny, because in my lectures, I get great joy out of telling the story, because almost everybody is familiar with it. And I say, you have a very close friend. You're very familiar with your friend's behavior. And you know your friend's parent. And at some point, you recognize that your friend shares the same behavior as their parents. So, you know, casually one day you offer a suggestion. You say, hey, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. You back away from Bill, because Bill's the first guy who's going to say, how can you say, you know that one, huh, Veronica? Okay, now, why this is funny is, first of all, everybody laughs, and then I say, yeah, now we laugh, and now let's get profound for a second. Here's what's profound. Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. Who doesn't see it? Bill. Well, then what does that mean? Well, it's an obvious expression of this. The subconscious behaviors that you got from other people, and this is especially in the first 6 years of our lives, those were the programs come from, the basic ones. Those are the basic programs that play in the subconscious. They're other people's behaviors, and when they play in that subconscious, you don't see them. Well, okay, now we got a problem. 95% of the day, I'm operating from the subconscious with behaviors that I don't see. And it's like, ah, so you don't see if your own behavior is sabotaging. The answer is, no, I don't see it. And all of a sudden, why is that relevant? Well, if I didn't see I was sabotaging myself, then I'm only left to conclude that something else is sabotaging me. And therefore, then I own the victim. And so here's the big important step. We have to first own the nature of the power of the subconscious mind. It's a million times more powerful than the conscious mind's as a computer, and it operates 95% of the time, and unfortunately, it is basically programmed by other people, because it's been programmed during the first 6 years of our lives. And it's interesting, because down in the Southern Hemisphere, here in Australia and New Zealand, they talk about this first 6 years of raising a child. They call it cutting the tall poppies. What they mean by that is, when a gardener plants poppies, they plant all the poppy seeds and they make a row of poppies. All the poppies come up to the same height. But every now and then, one, two, or three of the poppies shoot their heads up a foot or two above all the other poppies. And so what's the gardener to do? And the gardener is what? Cut the heads off the tall poppies. Well, what they mean by that, cutting the tall poppies in child raising, is that there's a tendency to, when a child shows traits beyond average, you bring the child back to average. You cut the head off the child. So you cut the behavior so that we're all less than powerful because now we're all average. Relevance about that is that this works in the States, and people don't know that because it's not a conscious thing. We're unaware of the fact, or have been, that the first 6 years is the programming part that determines the rest of your life. And it's interesting because you say, well, where am I getting this? So I said, well, I got it first through the sciences and the understanding of how the brain evolves, and that consciousness doesn't even really start in EEG activity as a predominant brain activity until after six. Meaning, brain function, EEG, a child is not fully conscious until after six. It's just below conscious. It's in a hypnotic trance up through six. And that's how the system downloads data, so that when consciousness comes online, when at six, has a database to operate from. So first you download data and then you use it. Well, here's an interesting point. Relatively new science, but guess what? The Jesuits, they've known this for 1,500 years. They've always had a saying, something like a couple of sayings. They would say, like, you give me the child and I will show you the man. But the most frequent heard one is, you give me a child until it's six or seven and will belong to the church for the rest of its life. What they knew is that whatever programs I put into you for the first 6 years, no matter what happens when you get conscious, those programs are still going to be the programs that are going to manifest for the rest of your life. So the
whole
Bruce,
I want to yell, uncle, uncle. I want to say, oh, my goodness. tell me,
please,
I
do.
Know we can make changes in that. I know we can. And there's another thing, and you're going to teach us how, but there's another thing I wanted to bring up, which is you mentioned, say, in Avatar, where we all go to see it, it brings out the core, kind of like the Down syndrome kids get to live with, in a way. So where is that core?
Yeah.
It's under or behind the subconscious, but it is available to us, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. Every human is born as what we call a human. Then we start to acquire our traits by our life experiences. And it's interesting because it says the traits, and there's a wonderful book, Why Love Matters, beautiful book, Why Love Matters by Sue Gerhard. And she has recognized through all the studies that a child's personality is halfway developed the day it's born. That the experiences as a fetus are downloaded into the memory of the child as it's evolving. And you say, well, what experience does a fetus have? And the answer is, and this is a very serious part, is that, yes, the mother's blood is used to nourish the fetus, but we only talk about the nourishment role of the blood. But we left out of the equation all these years that blood carries more than nutrition. It carries information. Our emotions and our chemistry of regulating our physiology are chemistry that's carried along with the blood. And so why that's relevant is when a mother has an emotional experience, which changes the chemistry of her blood, that chemistry crosses the placenta and the fetus experiences what the mother's experiencing. So it's now recognized if the mother is happy, the fetus is happy. If the mother is nervous or anxious, so is the fetus. Very importantly, if the mother rejects the fetus because of an unintended pregnancy or something like that, the fetus is bathed with that same emotional rejection chemistry. So what I'm saying is that repetitive patterns of the mother, repetitive patterns, are also repetitive chemical patterns played out in her blood, which then are repetitive patterns acquired by the fetus. So during the fetal development, the child is learning patterns of behavior through the chemistry. And so when it's born, it's already there. So I say, look, I start with this child, pure human, just this entity that is childlike when it's really first expressed, the wonderment of a child. That's children. And then I layer on top of that experiences. And I give it identity through these experiences. And the layers shape the character of that individual. We were all born as basic humans and then acquired a garment of personal identity. And that personal identity is basically through our life experiences, starting in utero, and then especially the first 6 years after that, and then the rest of our life we have an opportunity to rewrite and change those programs, but usually you first have to become aware of them before you do anything about it, and since that by definition they're invisible subconscious behaviors, most people don't even see them, so they're very hard to correct.
Or you think they're so ingrained they can't be corrected, right?
Well, that's what the belief is, and that's an unfortunate situation because as biology of belief reveals, is what you believe becomes your reality. And since most of us, that's where most of our limitations come from, because we acquire from other people beliefs about who we are and our limitations. And once we acquire them, then they become our set limitation. And it's only when people talk about miracles, like, oh, you can't heal ever after this accident, you'll never walk again. And some people don't buy that. And they have a completely different belief system that they're going to get out of there. And all of a sudden, these people have these remarkable healings. Then everybody says, oh, miracle, miracle. And it's like, well, it really wasn't as much as a miracle as a conscious intention that was overriding even any limitations the subconscious may have. So we create from these beliefs. I mean, the whole concept of spontaneous remission in cancer is, here's a person who's totally on their deathbed. Everybody's already counted them out. And they have the what? What is the common thing that underlies spontaneous remission? The answer is a profound change in perception or belief about life. And
now, do you believe, when you're talking about spontaneous evolution, you're saying there's going to be a huge leap in humanity's group capacity, aren't you?
Is that absolutely
what you're talking about on a massive level?
On a massive level, because humanity is like a human body where we're all cells in that human body, and just as much as a change of a belief of a human can restructure the 50 trillion cells, many of which in this terminal case may be cancerous, the change of belief, the cells restructured instantaneously, and that's why it's called spontaneous remission, and manifest health. Well, human civilization is a body that is undergoing its own degeneration from the internal conflict of all the cells shooting and killing each other, which is autoimmune disease. We're facing this autoimmune disease. And I said, well, how do we evolve? And the answer is just the exact same way that a cancer patient expresses a spontaneous remission. Humanity has this at its fingertips. When enough of us acquire a new belief about our personal empowerment and about how we can change the world, when we reach a critical level of that, then civilization will also express then a spontaneous remission from the deathbed that science says we're on right now. And a spontaneous remission is our evolution. Well, it's interesting is that old belief, which is incorrect, is that evolution is something that takes millions and millions of years through imperceptible changes, and you can't see it, but after millions of years, species A turns into species B. And that belief system, a Darwinian belief, is now found to be flawed. That it turns out evolution didn't go like that. Evolution took jumps, and there were these spontaneous jumps that occurred after mass extinctions, that all these organisms lived before the extinction. There's a mass extinction with 100,000 years. There's like all new things happening. And so basically it says evolution occurs on jumps. Punctuated equilibrium is a scientific term. And why is that relevant? It's because human civilization is at a jumping point. It doesn't really actually have a long time to go, because if we don't do something, scientists reveal that, for example, the food fish in the ocean will be fished out within 40 years. I think that there's a good limitation of what we're working on, a short period. We are going through an evolution, and the reality of that is can happen virtually overnight. It just
we're
going to
be breatharians.
Well, we actually should move that way, because here's a simple scientific truth that is now becoming a little more widespread, that one of the issues for our short lifespan is that we eat too much food. It's very interesting, because our belief system is food gives us energy and builds our bodies, and therefore we must eat this food. Then we habituate that we eat every day. You eat at 12 o'clock whether you're hungry or not, because it's called lunchtime. And so we eat by habit, and we eat this food by habit and belief. And it turns out the science has recognized that through many different organisms, when they've isolated organisms in different, you know, different, like people that were working with mice or rats or fruit flies or whatever organism they're working with, when they found organisms that live extra long and they tried to genetically say, wow, what give these organisms extra life? Every one of them essentially, and this is amazing, every one of them didn't have a gene that enhanced life. It had a gene that interfered with life. Genes that interfered with insulin pathway, which is the metabolic pathway. And what it basically said is all the organisms that lived longer out of the group that had this extra length, sometimes double the length, the lifespan, they lived longer because they couldn't digest their food very well. So obviously, the scientists that were studying this said, well, wait a minute. If that's all it is, what if I just took a bunch of regular organisms and put them on a subsistence diet, a very limited amount of food? And essentially, as soon as they did that, they doubled the lifespan of the organisms. And they basically now begin to see this is exactly the same story with humans. So guess what? Two birds handled with one stone. We begin to recognize that we survive and live longer on much less food, and as a consequence of that, we stop destroying the environment to grow all the food that we think that we need. So it's like, wow, win-win situation available right here in the immediate future.
So what else can we do? Eat less? What else can we do to increase the rate at which we're going to have this spontaneous evolution?
I start to recognize that the beliefs that we've operated under, especially the ones that shape our culture, like the Darwinian belief of evolution based on competition and a struggle and quest for becoming fittest, is actually irrelevant to evolution. Matter of fact, it actually retards evolution because evolution is not based on competition. We now know that evolution is based on cooperation. So basically it says we must pull out of the continuous competition we've all grown up in. We're, you know, weaned on competition everywhere. Competition is in everything because that's our belief system. And why is it irrelevant? Because nature doesn't care about the individual. If there was a big court where we had to go defend human civilization in a court of evolution saying, why should we keep humans? And we went to that courtroom and said, because we have great individuals. We had Mozart and we had Einstein. And the court would look at that and go, that's really nice, but who cares? I'll tell you why. Because it's the rest of you that are destroying the environment. It's what the group does, not what the individual does, that determines our evolution. And therefore, in a whole world based on being that individual, you know, fighting to be the best and the fittest and competing and knocking the other person down to get ahead, turns out to be just the opposite of what evolution is driven by. That we have to learn community and harmony, sharing, compassion. And when we start to do this, we live in a totally different way. And all of a sudden,
how about the economic system? Have you got advice on that?
I absolutely do. And it's fun because a lot of the information about how can we survive on this planet with 7 billion people? And the answer comes from, but recognize this, every cell in your body is a free living entity. I mean, I used to take them out of people's bodies and put them in tissue culture. They grow on their own. They have their own world going. Every cell is an individual. And then I said, guess what? Inside your body are 50 trillion cells. Every cell has a job. Some cells are skin, some are muscle, some are bone. They trade these specialties because a skin cell says, well, if I become skin, I can't do my digestion work. So they said, no, look, you become skin, we'll have the digestive system do the digestion. Exchange for your job, we'll give you food. And all of a sudden we start to find that, hey, 50 trillion cells, each with a job, living in community. Every cell gets the basics. Every cell has health care. Every cell gets a salary. When they get a job, they get a salary. So here's the interesting thing that's different than in our larger human world. How does cells handle the economy? And this is beautiful because if you understand it, then it's like, oh, my God, that was the answer. And it goes like this. Every cell gets paid. And there's actually a physical coin. It's called ATP. It's a molecule that represents like the equivalent of a gold coin because it's energy. And so the more work a cell does or the more important its job is, the more it gets paid. So skin cells don't get paid as much as nerve cells, for example. nerve cells do so well. They actually have an entourage that they can support to help them in their work. So basically, every cell gets a salary, and the salary is commensurate with the job. But guess what? Every cell gets health care for free. Every cell is fed for free, okay? And every cell is protected. This is a guarantee of the community. And now here comes the next part. Every cell gets paid, but guess what? They can make a certain maximum amount of money in the sense of energy molecules, and that's all they can make. Meaning they have enough energy beyond what they need, and this is like their little bank account. But here's the point. The rest of the energy or the money or the product that's produced, the rest of that goes to the community bank. And I, unfortunately, have a community bank around my waist here of this adipose. And what it is, it's a central bank. Well, so consider this. Every cell can make a maximum amount of money, which is beyond what it needs. And then the rest of the money goes into this community bank. Why? Because if I break my leg, I don't have to go up to the stomach and say, listen, guys, you want to loan me some energy so I could repair this leg? No. The community has all of this. The community has got all of this to support itself. So it says it's a free, it's a capitalistic system in the sense that, yes, you can get jobs that make a lot of money, and you can make a certain amount of money, but past that certain amount of money, it goes back to the community. And then here's the first big step in the understanding of wealth in the human body. There is no wealth called wealth in a human body until every cell has the basic coverage of life, until every cell is fed, until every cell is taken care of and protected and watched out for. There is no accumulation of wealth in that body. Once those are taken care of, then the extra production from the community becomes wealth. Which, in my case, we call it, it's not flattering, it's called adipose. And if you want to get less flattering, it's called fat. basically, is a bank deposit. And it's a bank deposit for the community. It's not a bank deposit for any individual cell. A cell in the pancreas can't make any more, money than any other cell until every cell gets basics covered. So then I say, so what does that mean for our world? It says, number one, human civilization can cover the basic needs of every human on this planet right now. There are many people who live on, say, a dollar a day in this world, and then you get people like, you know, Bill Gates with $60 billion, and there are people that can't afford even their dollar a day. This is a body out of balance. If we provide the basics, if everybody got food, and housing and healthcare, guess what would happen? The population would decline very quickly because one of the most important push behind a population increase is due to something that's not in our consciousness. It's below that. It's more fundamental to every living organism. It's called the biological imperative. Everyone is affected by it. Every organism from bacteria to humans is affected by it. And basically it says this, if you are threatened, if your life is threatened, you will do every maneuver possible to stay alive before you surrender. Even if you try to kill a bacterium, it will try to do everything it can to stay alive. There's some drive. Why should it stay alive? It's a drive. When your life is threatened, you begin to feel it in the pit of your gut that there's something going on. And guess what? We're all feeling that at some level. There's something going on here, folks. Yeah. And it affects your survival, and you're being driven by this biological imperative to make moves that will sustain your survival. And so we're awakening to the reality that there's a crisis, the crisis is life-threatening, and that it's important for us to recognize that we are part of the situation, and even our own gut is giving us that gnawing feeling, and it's the feeling that's going to push us into the next level of the spontaneous evolution, because we're going to reach a very critical mass soon of people who are going to think very differently, and the concepts of war and violence and competition and raping the planet will be old and ancient history, and we will be moving into a much, much better, saner, healthier world, and we'll model it after the cells, because If you can get 50 trillion cells to live in harmony under your skin and be blissed out, if you're blissed out, imagine an entire population of 50 trillion citizens all totally blissed out. That's available to human civilization, which is only 7 billion people. So,
well, I'm practicing it now.
I'm so glad you are. And it's very exciting. It's very exciting because it's empowering.
And yeah, we have to say goodbye, unfortunately. You could go on for a long time from my book.
We don't have to. We got a few more hours. I'm still here. Oh, okay, I know you guys. Thank you, Veronica.
I just want to say to everybody, Spontaneous Evolution is a very, very fascinating, interesting book that'll really lift you and give you a whole sense of being this, one of the cells in the whole human experience. And I really think it's great, Bruce. Thank you.
And
are
so
you going to be talking? Are you going to be doing anything else that we want to keep in touch with?
Well, I don't know. We have a wonderful website where the kinds of stuff that I'm talking about are actually involved with articles that you can download and read so that they're free. Just go to the website, bruceflipton.com, and other pieces of information trying to get our community of humans to recognize their basic humanity and evolve from this into something far better that's right in front of us.
Well, great. I'll see you on the other side of the evolution there.
Veronica, thank you again. I so appreciate this.
Me too. I really am grateful you came on, and I know I feel pretty inspired. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for all the work you're doing.
Thank you.
All right. Good night. This is Veronica Entwistle saying, what a wonderful, wonderful evening to spend time with Bruce Lipton calling from New Zealand. We're going to be on with Jackie Salvitti, and oh no, we're not on Thursday night. We're doing a show, Radiance by Design, at 7 o'clock. It's a call-in show, and we're going to continue on mothering. And I thought, because of Bruce, it'll be mothering and evolution, or mothering our evolution. And we'll do meditations and call-ins. And Jackie, we're going to do a rerun of one of her shows because she's preparing for her big intensive this coming weekend. Next week on Paradigm Shifters, at 8 o'clock on Tuesday, I've got a call in to Steve Behrman, who also wrote with Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution, and I would really like to have his point of view as well. So that will hopefully be our next week's guest. This is Veronica Entwistle saying, remember, call in. I was going to ask Bruce about the frequencies, new frequencies. Let's call in some of the new frequencies that really come through us and help fill us with that ability to be free to love. Take in some love and send it out to everyone listening to BBS Radio, the BBS Radio Global Community. Much love. Thank you for listening. Good night.